Next is a meeting with disciples on May 1st, 1995, in Rodendaes, Belgium.
This is our question and answer session. And although I prepared a little bit by looking at the questions in advance and taking some notes, these are not thorough researched or written answers as I would want to do if I thought of it as being put into a book or something. Sometimes the topic is a very big topic. Tell us something about humility, request maybe. So tendency might be to say, oh, I can't answer this at all. But there's something to be gained by, as we'd say, a top-of-the-head reply. After all, we're supposed to be living this life of Krishna consciousness and know answers to questions, having heard them before, also answered by Prabhupada and read about them. But still, I just wanted to say that these kind of quick answers, they omit all kinds of ramifications and further fine-tuning that could be made. But you can just try to appreciate them in that way, that when you're kind of forced to give a quick reply, that here's the gist, the gut reaction, and it has a particular value in itself, but not to be confused or compared to a thorough answer. I'm going to start out with something that is left over from the selected topics that devotees gave me before I came here. Actually, I stapled together three things that are all hovering around similar subject matter. And after each of these, any more conversation we want to have on it, we have before I go to the next one. Any questions or comments? So my remark first before reading this devotee's statement is that his topic is finding one's best situation in Krishna consciousness so that one can serve spontaneously and not by force or mechanically. So here's what he wrote to me. So I'm reading his statement so that you can get the full flavor of, he's got a viewpoint. Not just that he's asking me something. One particular subject that I would find inspiring at a guru-disciple meeting would be the importance of understanding that we have to pursue our relationship with Guru and Krishna, even when others may not fully appreciate our reasons for preferring one aspect of devotional service over another. For example, it was not made easy for the devotees in Wicklow to come here and settle down with our families. A lot of devotees leveled all sorts of criticisms, some still do, from being selfish in our Krishna consciousness to deserting the deities, Radha Madhava and Radha Govinda. On the contrary, you have always been very supportive and encouraging, while at the same time ready to correct us when needed. I personally am very grateful to you when I read your books and see how you're determined to practice your spiritual life with mature realization and conviction of what is natural, your writing and sadhana, etc., and sustainable. Hence, your Krishna consciousness is spontaneous rather than mechanical. So, therefore, some instruction on finding a bona fide situation in Krishna consciousness would be helpful. It certainly was crucial in my case. Now I'm just going to go on to the other two questions. These are both from here. In yesterday's disciples meeting, you were talking about doing the needful and what you like to do in Krishna consciousness. Is it that when we first come to the movement, we should do the needful? This is actually from Belfast, I got this. Is it that when we first come to the movement, we do the needful, then after so many years of doing the needful, then we can do some service we'd like to do? But doesn't surrender mean to do what Krishna wants us to do, even if we don't like it? But we do it anyway, to please Krishna. Should we then not surrender to doing the needful? And the question I got here is almost the same as that one. I once heard you said during a Bhagavatam class that a devotee has no plans except one plan, how to fulfill the plan of Krishna. I've also read in your books that individual desire to serve Krishna in a particular way is important. And because service in Krishna consciousness is for the whole lifetime, we should find a place and service which we like to do. So these two points, complete surrender and individual desire, are not clear to me. I think the answer kind of pops out when the devotee sort of states it in extreme and says that, do we do the needful when we first come and then later do what we want to do? That doesn't sound quite right. So do the needful is always a model. But the needful may vary. And think of like the needful for a little Gurukul child and the needful for an adult devotee practicing for a good number of years. The Gurukul child needs to just do what he's told. And there's nothing else. It's not good for him. He doesn't know to exercise what he wants to do. So his surrender is like that. Now, somebody said, what is the comparison of that surrender, doing whatever his teacher tells him to do, with the later surrender? Sounds like the first one is better. Later, when you get older, what is it that you start picking and choosing? No, actually, ideally, when we say do what you want to do, we're referring to the more mature stage where the devotee is not just being told by somebody else what you should do, but with his whole self, body, mind, and words, he's surrendering. And that also includes using his own initiative, because it's by free will that we go back to Godhead when we actually surrender to Krishna. So there's a sort of lack of free will or totalness in the child's surrender. He just doesn't know the full implication of surrender. We don't think of the older devotee who may be specializing in what he loves to do and doing something for Krishna that way, rather than being always told by an authority, as being less of surrender. So that's one one reply. Prabhupada used to say that if you know Krishna consciousness yourself, it's not that someone has to give you a certificate that you are Krishna conscious. It's just like a hungry person. He knows that he's hungry. Who else can find out authentically whether he's hungry? He knows only. So he said, you will know by your satisfaction, by your non-interest in material desire and anything else, so on. Whereas the immature devotee, he doesn't have that self-awareness even. I've told you that joke I heard about the sort of like a caricature of the immature bhakta when there was a very intensive bhakta program. All the bhaktas would live under one director. I think the pioneer of the bhakta program as it used to exist was the Vipramukhya and Dhanavir. They had these very rigid programs that started in Los Angeles and England. So the typical bhakta didn't know anything except what he was told to do. And so they used to say, you know, they would ask the bhakta, you know, where is your dhoti? I don't know. I'll have to ask Vipramukhya. And then ask him something else, you know. Are you going on Sankirtan? I don't know. I'll have to ask Vipramukhya. So he was very surrendered and willing, but didn't know nothing. So, of course, you could make a similar caricature to some doing what you want, some laid-back devotee who says, you know, that, yeah, I do what I want. That's the Krishna. So today I feel like watching 5 hours of TV. And I'm just not up to, I don't feel like getting up early. But I think the general outline was what I said in the beginning. So So I liked this, what this devotee wrote, how I stayed with him even when others were not so supportive and saw the good in what he was trying to do. In this case, it's a success story. A devotee like Uddhava, who was very much working in one way in ISKCON temples and then moved out, but had something in mind that was a vision, and that they're gradually attaining, which is very appreciative, appreciated by devotees as a rural kind of development for householders. It's not just one way. And so he appreciated that the spiritual master didn't fail to appreciate him. And he said that because I also, the implication that I might be doing something that I also know I have to keep a vision for, because I know it's right, and even if others may not always know it's right. It's a little bit subtle point. I know some devotees feel this is when you get subtle, it starts getting dangerous and they start getting confused. They want things to be very rigid and simple. They say, well, I don't know, why are you saying that? I thought that we're just supposed to do whatever we're told, and it doesn't matter whether we like it or not. But that's not really the full definition of Krishna consciousness. There is a time for that. You could say, like Arjuna, maybe he was in that situation. He didn't want to do what Krishna wanted in the beginning, but he surrendered to Krishna. But then Krishna taught him the whole Bhagavad Gita, so there's the other side of it. If you say, well, this, the Bhagavad Gita, that exemplifies that you just do what you're supposed to do, not what you want to do. Arjuna wanted to do something, it was nonsense, and Krishna said, you're a nonsense, do what I want. That's true, but Krishna also taught the whole Bhagavad Gita, and then he said, now you do whatever you like. You decide. So they're both there. He acted with full understanding when he said, yes, now my doubts are removed. I will act in your service. We don't act by force or blindly. And it's an individual thing, too. It's not, somebody else might not get the support of the spiritual master, might not get my support for what he was planning to do. Let's say at least that one is fortunate if he can give his love to Krishna. You know, I mean that which you love something and you give it to Krishna, then you're in a fortunate position. Package of similar questions dealt with. Is there any further remark? This is a repeat also from the disciples' meeting. I thought there was enough there to go over it again and even give you a little review of what this was. This is from a disciples meeting we had in Ireland, and Manu threw me a kind of a curveball. I can't remember exactly, but he said that sometimes when I write I do some imaginary thing, like I imagine as if I was actually talking to Prabhupada and I write something out, or I once imagined that I was back in 1966 and I wrote a diary as a brahmachari, putting myself in some imaginary situation. So he suggested I put myself in an imaginary situation of being a disciple of Satsvarupa Maharaj. And then he had a number of questions like what was it like in regard to my relationship with Prabhupada as that disciple and this and that. And it just kind of blew my mind, and I couldn't imagine myself because I was too much trying to answer the question from the other position. But I did approach it I made some points, and I'll repeat some of them. Manu may remember some more that were made. I thought they might be valuable this year. So my first point was that I couldn't enter that space that he asked me to. But I did look at the relationship, and the way I can see the relationship is when I see it working successfully in my disciples. In their service, in their satisfaction. When I see it working, it's kind of a proof. Like when the light bulb goes on, you know, the electricity is connected. And I admired that. I don't think of it in terms of my success, but the system is working and it's successful. And I'm in awe of it. I appreciate their humility. We've seen, for example, a phenomena of devotees who were initiated by ISKCON gurus and then those gurus fell down. That tragedy is mostly behind us in its worst feature, but so many devotees had to go through that and with different responses. And some of the devotees, they got a little arrogant almost and said that actually we don't need any spiritual master and Prabhupada is our spiritual master. I still am sympathetic to those devotees. I never pushed devotees to get reinitiated. But on the other hand, positively, I admired the humility of those, some of them devotees for many years, who felt that there was a need to take a new spiritual master and did. So aside from that case, those who just take a spiritual master without that trauma, I see it in all these cases when I see it working. And I think this is it's a wonderful thing. Although I can't imagine that position, I see it, that it works. So I have that faith that, so say theoretically, if I was in that position, I hope I would have that humility. And I see that other examples of how it works and how you can also... then I would also say that, well, the spiritual master, the ISKCON spiritual master, he should definitely represent Srila Prabhupada so that the devotee can have a direct relationship with Prabhupada. Because I was asked to imagine that. How do you imagine your direct relationship with Prabhupada? So at least I can see that it's working. And I know that it can work that way. And then I know that they can, not only in this generation, but in past generations, there have been such strong connections with devotees and previous gurus. So it can be done. But they do it through the parampara. I also repeated an example I'd given once in Italy, which was appealing to me. It sounded convincing to me. It's about as close as I can get also to imagining the position in advocating new generation. Yes, you should take initiation from a representative of Prabhupada, one of his disciples who's initiating. You should take initiation from him. How can we say this with conviction? one example... I gave in Italy with perhaps some particular effectiveness there because I gave the example of the patron saint of Italy, Saint Francis of Assisi. I said, say that you were a young person and you heard, of course, about Francesco, and you actually were yourself religiously inclined and you aspired, I would like to follow him, be like him. Oh, what a wonderful saint. So how would you practically go about that? Since he lived so many centuries ago, what do you do to find him? Not just to dream about him, but you want to actually follow a life of Saint Francis. So you will hear that he started a movement, Franciscans, and they're supposed to embody his ideals. So you go to one of their centers and try meet some of them. You'll notice, they dress like he did, and some of the things you see you might not like. For sure, you probably would see things you didn't like. It doesn't seem like what I read about or heard about Saint Francis. But we hope you would find some person persons, maybe person particularly, who you would think, well, this person, he's just like, not just like St. Francis, but he seems to be a real follower in embodying these ideals of devotion to God and poverty, detachment and everything. And so he really seems to have a spark of that, which I'm seeking in the great saint, who is unattainable at this time, having left his body so long ago. So then you would join that order under the guidance of that person. So I thought a parallel like that could be made, taking Prabhupada in the parallel to St. Francis. But what are you going to practically do if you want to follow Prabhupada? Try to find somebody who you think is representing Prabhupada. And Prabhupada has a movement, and he worked for this movement, so you join it, and like that. And then you get what you originally wanted. You didn't originally think, I want to join a movement, you were inspired by the vision of Krishna consciousness taught by Srila Prabhupada. So that's what you get in the end, whether you were in 1960s living and you met Prabhupada, or now, the same thing is available. By the principle of we should be servant of the servant of the servant, 100 times removed, these devotees are more qualified than we were then. The old timers, they have all their nectar stories. Sometimes they have some of these reunions, you know, the old timers turn up and they got big beards and maybe even smoking a cigarette outside, and then they sit down, they tell some great stories, and everyone is very appreciative of it. But you know, they become a little chipped away by time and Maya. So it's not necessarily that we think, you know, because he was there in the beginning, he's developed into the best kind of devotee of Prabhupada. Rather, we honor that he was there and he has these stories in his contact. But it can be like after the reunion day is over and he goes back to whatever it is he's doing, playing in a rock band and smoking or whatever. When we get down to business, and the devotees who are preaching and really practicing with Prabhupada's movement, they're not even his direct disciples. So that, I mean, no one has to make much of an argument to say that the new generation is as much connected to Prabhupada, or can be, as the old. So we also hope that will be more generally recognized, that there's not so much of a two-tier caste system in ISKCON between junior devotees and senior devotees. That probably will dissolve when all the, quote, senior devotees have gone. It'll be hard to say who's a senior, although maybe since we have such a tendency for casteism, there'll be a new senior devotee and a new junior devotee. What generation are you? I'm third generation. Well, I'm second generation. Nityananda Bhamsa, again. I hope that imagining myself, I hope that I would serve my spiritual master. And especially I would take from his absolute teachings, his stress on that which is absolute, the chanting and the hearing, and that I would have no doubts about what he was teaching. I would accept him in a generic way, as a bona fide spiritual master, not make judgments on his material background or body, knowing the Shastras fully support us. No, don't look at a Vaishnava like that he's an American, or he's Chinese, or he's old, or he has infirmity, and so on. I hope I would develop a friendly service relationship in Vani and Papu. Are there some things more, Ramana, that either I said or that were churned up in you?
About the spiritual master making mistakes, and you're saying that it's not just you might make a mistake quoting a slogan, but then you're referring to mental instruction that if you see an imperfection in your spiritual master, it's your fault. But you should always see the spiritual master is always absorbed in thinking of improving Krishna consciousness.
Oh yeah.
And that he would so he would talk to you about these different matters as well.
Yeah. I remember that discussion, Kim, because that's one of Pragosha's favorite topics to get into about that. Yeah, so you covered that. Yeah. If you thought there was something faulty, which you couldn't just brush off as material, then you can bring that up to the spiritual master for discussion.
As a disciple, you would also love that the spiritual master would open to sensitive questions, not just criticizing or finding fault or such type of questions, but questions which are asked to make your faith stronger.
Yeah. In what way?
How you found ways. Sometimes you're talking about an ending. Sometimes you feel that it's just an ending.
Oh.
And
to
make it stronger.
Yeah. Sometimes I might feel some unwanted criticism in the mind coming from something Prabhupada said or did. So then, rather than just run away from it, so try to deal with it by talking with a god brother or writing about it and coming to terms with it. So if the mind does that with Prabhupada, then it's certainly going to do it after him with others. Yeah, just the fact that if you could remove it, if it was like there, sometimes one of our internal organs is inflamed or something and it's pushing against other things and it ruins our well-being, puts us ill at ease. And then if you can cure that, then what a great gain it is. Everything is happy. So you can start out negative and then if you can remove it. Very positive. That book that I wrote, Here is Srila Prabhupada, it's not that I start each time negatively, but I just kept trying to start like negatively, like what is there? You know, how do I feel about Prabhupada now? And I would write repeatedly, go to write, how do I feel about Prabhupada? And different things would come out, but it almost always would end up positively. If there was anything lack of positive, it was my just feeling that I couldn't remove some fallen thing, some anartha within myself. But I didn't wind up feeling fault with Srila Prabhupada. Genuine, we want the genuine thing, not to live with some false, super positive image of either the spiritual master or ourself that doesn't tally with our inner feelings and our experience. Like that story, the emperor's new clothes. You don't want to be like that. Okay, any more on that? Question. You mentioned we may not be thinking I have any doubts, but we can see the manifestation of unseen doubts by our lacking to practice Krishna consciousness with full confidence and without full surrender to Krishna's will. Can you go through ways to look out for these practical ways to see our doubts? You may not be thinking I have any doubts, but we can see the manifestation of unseen doubts by our lacking to practice Krishna consciousness with full confidence and without full surrender to Krishna's will. Can you go through ways to look out for these practical ways to see our doubts? I started by way of answer listing proofs or manifestations of my having doubts where I might not think that I had doubts. One, I don't thrill to Krishna's words and names at every moment. Now you may say, well, how does that, that doesn't mean that you have a doubt, does it? But I think it does, if you can think of these things that way. Two, I dwell on earthly attachments, desires of the tongue for particular pleasing tastes, etc. If I had full faith that I am spirit soul, why would I act this way? I say, I'm spirit soul. Does everyone believe that? Are you convinced? Yes, I am spirit soul. Then why are you acting like you're this body? So it implies that you don't have full faith in this. Devotees would sometimes ask Prabhupada about eating. If prasadam is really absolute, what about prasadam that's gone stale or is rotten? And Prabhupada would say, it depends on your faith. Don't imitate it if you don't have that faith. But if somebody was completely faithful, he could do all kinds of things that are transcendental to the body. So I have to admit it, I don't have that much faith that I'm not this body. 3, if someone threatens my life with a weapon, etc., I become full of fear. Thus I doubt my eternal unkillable nature. I should not have any fear. But I'd like to give the example of Socrates, who was fearless at death because of his full conviction and belief in the immortality of the soul. Now you can kill me, but you don't kill me, you kill my body. He chided his students that they failed to understand what he had taught them. My various manifestations of anger, lust, greed, etc., show that I don't trust that these things are all completely detrimental to my self-interest, and that I'll have to pay karma for them. Faith, conviction. That this is so important. I must stop these things that are detrimental to my self-interest. So we tend to think that our self-interest is not exactly surrender to Krishna as first and foremost, but a lot of other things. Also, my lack of faith is shown in how I treat the deity in the temple. Further explanation of digging out the fact that we do have doubts, I put in a positive way. Oh boy, I didn't have the place. Bhakti Ras, do you remember what page that was? Oh, here it is, yeah. In begging for the nectar of the holy name, I quoted Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Harinam Chintamani, that he, after describing the 10 offenses, he instead of putting them as don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, he changes them around to do this, and do this, goes through the 10 offenses. So by reading these, it's sort of in a similar mood to what I just expressed. But if we really had faith in the holy name, we wouldn't act the way we do. And therefore we have to admit that we are committing the 10 offenses. Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains the 10 offenses are in one sense just a negative way of expressing things. We have to go beyond merely avoiding the 10 offenses. He then quickly turns around each of the 10 offenses and expresses them in their true positive light. 1. We should not only avoid offending Vaishnavas, we should love them and serve them. We should not only theoretically understand that the holy name is the same as Krishna, and that Krishna's name is supreme, we should always chant it with joy and surrender. We should not only avoid disobeying the order of the Guru, but he should be our best friend, and we should dedicate our lives to him. We should read the Vedic literature with faith in the transcendental word of Shastra. That would be the positive. Of the negative is, do not blaspheme the Vedic literature. Oh, I would never do that. I keep the books in my room locked. I never read them, but I don't say anything bad about Vedic literature. I don't say anything at all about it. We should forever rid ourselves of the whole concept of sin and lead a saintly life. We should never think of the holy name as pious activity, but serve it wholeheartedly. And we should preach the glories of the Lord to the faithful. That's a nice reverse of don't preach the glories of the Lord to the unfaithful, but preach to the faithful. Or to be said to the innocent. So that's some talk about admitting doubts in ways that may not seem so obvious. Any more on that? time for a break, japa break. It would be nice if Prabhupada writes in the book, what is it? One of those old nectar old-time books, The Science of God, A Message of Godhead, how he hopes someday, he preaches that the industrialists should have a deity in the factory, and they should have prasadam distribution and breaks for kirtan. They have coffee breaks and take a japa break. How nice that would be. At least we can do. Hare Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasudeva Gaura Bhaktivedanta Hare Krishna. Yeah? Well, it's an important distinction. He's certainly more advanced. He's more free from doubts. If the like Bhagavad Gita says, the person to whom desires may enter, but he doesn't get agitated, is like the river, like the ocean, into which tons and tons of water are poured, but the ocean doesn't get agitated by that. So if you could be like that, then you're fixed. So that means that different input may come, but he doesn't identify with it, doesn't latch onto it, or really worry about it or think about it. Then to the degree that he actually doesn't got attached to it, you could just see it objectively that it may pass through your mind. Well, one could doubt like this. One could doubt that how can the statue actually receive the food? I realize that people may ask a question like that, but and then you immediately can give the answer. That's preaching, that's not doubt. But the preacher is aware, Prabhupada was aware of all the doubts, although he had no doubts. So it depends when it passes through your mind, if you think of it, that this is what some people say, or is it actually your own feeling? Like that first day we played the tape, Prabhupada said, when they hear about Govardhan, they say, and we say, we say also. Oh, these are stories. So you have to judge yourself whether you feel a pinch. If you see a picture, that provoking picture of the opposite sex, does it pinch you? Does it provoke you? If so, that means you have lust in your heart. Otherwise, you don't have lust. Lord Chaitanya, in regard to that, he said that even if I see the wooden form, doll of a woman, I become disturbed. To give us an example of how difficult that is. So doubts, you have to be wary of them, and then defeat them, and don't be attached to them. I think that answers your question. So that when the doubt occurs as a theoretical thing, or as something that they say, the scientists say, Prabhupada, when the devotees, they would bring up, they would say, Prabhupada, they say, and he would right away sometimes suspect that the devotee wasn't just saying what they say, but he also was affected by that. And sometimes turn on the person and say, that's because you are a rascal. And the devotee would say, that's not me, Prabhupada. It's what they say. And he would detect that that maybe you're actually attached. Of course, we were talking about that too, how it's nice to debate. But with Prabhupada, he would sometimes turn on the mock debater. And we knew, too, that we were raising questions that were our doubts. I used to do that often. So often that Prabhupada, sometimes when he wanted something, he would say, turn to me and say my name, and he'd say, you sometimes side with them. What could be the objection to transmigration? What do they say? So right away I would jump in, give some doubt, which is actually partially a doubt that I may have had deeper in myself, and wanted to hear Prabhupada argue against.
So
so have to keep working at it to remove the doubts. I've often heard devotees refer to your books as easy reading. I also find that due to the openness and honesty in your writings, they do appear to be and are very accessible. I like this. However, I've also found that on the rare occasions when I have slowed down enough to be able to thoughtfully read and observe your books, especially the poetry, that there's a lot more to them than meets the eye. Can you tell us of the best ways we can approach your books, how you'd like us to read them and include them in our lives? I think the books themselves, they answer this better than I can in person and speaking. I'm not shy to write, but I'm so much shy to talk about it. And it's somehow right to be that way. It's just kind of a private world in which, by being private, then later one can share it, but in the written word, not so much in the talking. Recently, when I was in Guyana, I was traveling in the car and hadn't seen the devotees there in 2 years. We were sort of getting reacquainted, and I was asking him, how are you doing and what are you doing? And then one devotee asked me, he said, could you tell me what you're writing now? Are you working on any project of writing? And I said, something evasive. And then I told him later, I said, when you asked me that, what I felt like saying to you is, "You why don't you just read what I publish? Rather than asking me what I'm doing next." I said, "You haven't even read what I published." So because to ask a writer what he's writing now, it's really prying into a process that's too delicate to talk about, because maybe something will happen to it that will disturb its completion by talking about it. And that kind of gives an indication. I don't know if I've written things about that, about what my disciples might, how they might. Probably haven't written much, because I don't like to write with an exclusive voice as if books are addressed to disciples. But being put on the spot by the question, I think it is very important to me to do. And so from my point of view, it has to have some connection to my service, and my practically my main service to ISKCON is to take care of disciples and try to relate to them and keep myself fit for them so that they can have smooth flow in their service to Krishna. Therefore, if I'm spending a lot of time in writing, it better have some connection to that service. Therefore, it is something that I give to those devotees. And so I hope that they read the books. The question is, the best way is to approach them. So I like it when they approach them eagerly and with interest and sort of get the point, not miss the point. Sometimes they get a point even better than I would imagine it. Like with this book, sometimes devotees write to me and said when you point out the faults in your chanting, I take it that you're addressing my faults. And I said, oh, that's a very generous or right way to take it, rather than get disturbed that he's supposed to be a senior devotee, why is he having problems chanting? So that would be an example of a good way to take the books as important and with the right understanding. I like them to give pleasure and to be instructive. So how to include them in your lives. Of course, it's up to you, as much as you can and do take them. I don't try to assist, but I'm happy when anybody in the world tells me that the books are meaningful. Tonight, maybe. From my point of view, I'm very happy and satisfied that I could serve in that way. And if they actually get benefit, then again, to give you the answer, I could tell you about other devotees and what they say, how they've included in their lives. And some say they get access to Prabhupada, to the books that are written about Prabhupada. And some say it's a solace in their life to be able to read the books, and they can get regular instructions and so on. I don't know. So I can't really tackle the answer so much more than that. At least I don't think we should leave it out of our relationship. It's too big a thing that I'm doing, too much me, for us to have an important relationship and you not to be interested in that. Anymore? Okay. Next, finding myself. Does this mean A, hearing from Shastra who I really am, eternal spirit soul? B, finding out my conditioning in the present body and realistically dealing with my present modes? So self-realization means both. The word swadharma can be used for both your varnashram occupation and your eternal relationship with Krishna. So self-realization, in the absolute sense, it starts with aham brahmasmi. I am eternal Brahman, eternal spirit. And it goes all the way up to rasa. I am a gopa, and my name is so-and-so, and my service to Krishna is, I bring the betel nuts, whatever it is, and my clothing is like this, I wear a red turban, and so on. That's all self-realization. That's all the under his A, that's the Shastra, eternal spirit understanding. Now, there's not much we can do about that in the beginning. Can't really get into our rasa. But that's what it means. But the second type, therefore, is important within for the conditioned soul in varnashram, or what Prabhupada calls psychophysical nature. No one should like dismiss this. Oh, this is nonsense, mundane psychology. We just want to know aham brahmasmi, or we want to know our rasa. But to get to that, you have to work with the living being in his conditioned state. Of course, not by conditioned methods, by spiritual methods. But psychophysical nature is also where we're at. It may be possible to completely go completely go to the second stage, to the absolute stage. But for most of us, we require satisfaction of the other stage, and therefore it's necessary. You could completely discount your modes of nature and everything else, just chant Hare Krishna and be liberated. We sometimes preach like that. Chant Hare Krishna and your life will be sublime. As if, you know, you just chant Hare Krishna and you're liberated. In a sense, it's true, in an absolute sense, but those of us who really are on the path, you know, have to deal with so many things. I don't see some dichotomy here. But don't confuse them. Don't think that my working on varnashram, that's the absolute. To be happy, get a good job, and live peacefully, this is what's necessary. That other stuff, that's too elevated. No, that's no good either. Varnashram is just a temporary stepping stone to get to the higher stage. But it's necessary. Okay, self-realization. Yes.
Uh-huh. about thinking that thing with a mental grad, you know, you have to need to just do it once mental and then you're not going to get the result. But actually to do it you have to see that thing happen as well. And I remember one time my friends were and we were doing the mini-class and they left the road with me and I didn't think I was getting the time and I thought then he showed me what he was doing and he was writing down all the different lessons to this.
I find most of the time I'm just performing my service mechanically. When I was in Vrindavan a few years ago, I found I prayed a lot. There was something about the atmosphere, I found it very conducive for praying. How can I become more prayerful in my service and not just perform it mechanically? I want to answer this in a particular way, taking the question to be, how can I be prayerful while in the routine of devotional service? And I would like to say something in favor of routine consciousness. Prabhupada used that word in a favorable way, doing the routine work. And that is that in the routine, that's when all things develop nicely. You might also describe it as like the mode of goodness. The patient time, patience is required. It's like Prabhupada gives the example of a pregnant woman, how she has to wait and care for herself 9 months, and then a child comes. So, so many good things develop like that. And so it's an art, important one, because that's our major time, we hope. Hope we're not just always in some crisis management or passion. But rather we should look for routine, we should look for goodness that goes like that. I remember Burijan Prabhu telling me about that with Gurukul. I would ask him, how are things going? The Gurukul, when he was at Kitanagri, and he would emphasize that the best situation is when everything is externally uneventful. You know, there's no, you can see that even in Vrindavan Gurukul, when there are festivals and the school goes haywire, the kids they can't follow their schedules and everything is upset by the festivals. But he would say, you know, that what may even appear boring, just the day-by-day routine without any special things is the best for learning by the children. You know, so they can just pay attention. So at least we shouldn't think that we really, you know, when is the next marathon? When is the next Rath Yatra so that I can stay up all night and I really feel fired up instead of this boring routine. But prayer also means routine. That I have in quiet. I pray in quiet. That's why do traditionally so many sadhus, they look for a quiet place to pray, to chant and meditate, because then with all the outer distractions gone, I can look within. So prayer, we look within our routine for prayer, and so don't at least equate the routine with mechanics. And that you have to go to Vrindavan, or you have to fast, or you have to be in a marathon, and only then do you get in touch with Krishna. If that's really true, then how come when you get out of that atmosphere, you don't feel like that, you know? If it's really Krishna, you don't forget Krishna. You really contact Krishna. So I'm putting in a good word for the routine. But you have to find it. Find that that goodness and be grateful for it and produce and use it as very conducive. Don't waste time. I know myself, especially if you have a good routine, sometimes my routine changes a lot. But sometimes when I have a good routine and it's productive, and I notice the days are going by, and I'm doing so many things on a 24-hour basis. I'm doing them all at the exact same time, you know, down to all little details. And that means that you're, in a sense, like you're really exerting control over your time in sadhana. You put the piece of tilak in the same place, and you know, you close this door, and you do this, and you're noticing I'm in the flow of activities that are I'm exactly on time every day. I'm doing the same thing. And then you can really start to concentrate at the jobs before you. Say, all right, now it's the time to read this book. And you can really pour yourself into it. Now it's the time to honor prasadam. Now it's the time to chant my rounds. But if it's like, oh, the schedule is all up in the air, and now do this, now do this. And so you're not doing things. When you're chanting, you're doing the next thing, actually, and then people are intruding, and everything is upset. So we may take it that these almost bizarre changes are some stimulated spiritual life, but not necessarily. Oh, I tacked on another question to it because it seems similar. You say that we now live in a comfortable institution, ISKCON. Sometimes part of that comfort is to think that just by joining, we have made it. How can we avoid complacency and be aware of the urgency of Krishna consciousness? So while in the routine, yeah, don't lull yourself into forgetfulness a bit, but be aware that we're not mature, and we don't have so much time left to live, and we want to reach our goal. But my point was that the quickest way to reach the goal often is just by the mode of goodness, routine duties. So if we can get a good patch of uninterrupted days and weeks, then we can really make progress. Like in one sense, when Maharaj Pariksit knew he had only 7 days, he did intensify everything. He gave up his kingdom, very dramatic moves he made, stop eating, stop drinking. But in another sense, what he did was...
Next is an excerpt from a Srimad Bhagavatam compilation.
I don't know about everyone's reading habits, whether you actually take time to read on a daily basis. But I think at least when we come together, I should spend time that I sit down and read with you. That's what we're doing now. You get accustomed to this, and then you can go on reading on your own. I'm rightly situated when I do this. Read Prabhupada to you and Bhagavatam and make some comments. All right, next.
The world is not a material object whose presence one has to feel with such association. The Lord is present everywhere at all times. It is quite possible to have his association simply by following his instructions, because the Lord in his instruction and the Lord is in his name, fame, attributes and paraphernalia are identical with him, being absolute knowledge. 1:12:24.
Prabhupada has that first sentence in italics for emphasis. The Lord is not a material object whose presence one has to feel for such association. He's present everywhere at all times. It is quite possible to have his association simply by following his instruction. So this, by reading into this, in the sound vibration of this room, our hearing Krishna's presence, more or less according to your receptivity. Next.
My Lord, devotees like your good self are verily holy places personified. Because you carry the personality of Godhead within your heart, you turn all places into places of privilege. 1:13:10. A pure devotee like the Guru always feels the presence of the Lord. God is always with such pure devotees because of their unalloyed service. which is without any change of spiritual action or Euclidean speculation.
That's an often quoted verse. Here's the purport. From the purport to it, read. Oh, you read that, yeah. So the previous selection said that Krishna is present in his instruction. Now we hear that Krishna is carried, especially in the heart of the pure devotee. So wherever the pure devotee goes, it's a tirtha. And what is the specialty of that person that he's called a tirtha, a moving tirtha? Because he serves Krishna without any mixture of other motives like karma or jnana, pure devotee. You can, I'll just raise your hand anytime you want to participate like that. Okay, Nick.
This frightful situation cannot be remedied by any person in this material world. My Lord, it is the Supreme Personality of Godhead at eternal time, Kali, that has approached us all. 1:13:19. There was no remedial measure by anyone or from any source in this material world. And because there is no such thing in the material world, death is identical with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as it is said by the Lord himself in Bhagavad Gita, 10:34, 1:13:19. This is a verse spoken by Vidura to Dhritarashtra, where he tells him to get out of home immediately. There is no remedial measure for the imminent fearful situation. We should also see it as Krishna coming in our own lives and place.
This continues the string of the same theme, that Krishna is present. Krishna is present in his teachings. Krishna is present in the pure devotee. And now, in an unusual unusual way perhaps, to think of it, but Krishna present in the frightful situation of things that you can't change in the material world, like old age and death. They are identical with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. God is the most powerful force whom no one can change or stop. So, try to think of an example of something that nobody can change or stop. Old age, death. So therefore, that is a way to understand God is present. Now, you say, well, that's not so Nectarean. I prefer another way. But we prefer all ways. We want to see God at every moment. So I see him in the irreversible things that are sometimes frightening. And then they become not frightening. And I realize that Krishna's behind this. And then I turn to Krishna in more palatable forms, or of more personal shelter, like his holy name. But in any case, it's Krishna in one form or Krishna in another form. Not without Krishna. Therefore, we're called Krishna conscious. That gets back, that can bring us back to the first class I gave here. Are you convinced? Do you have faith that Krishna is here in every situation, in every place? This is the real faith. Or is Krishna just some faint light at the end of the tunnel, or just a thin thread in the midst of your complicated life of confusion? It's not that the pure devotee doesn't also grow old or have all these other different things happen, but in each case they see Krishna. But when we have weak faith, it's like our Krishna conscious, our awareness of Krishna comes strong in certain things, and then it goes down and comes up again. We see Krishna a little there, but we don't see him here.
and that is the nature of a good man and devotee of the Lord. A devotee never finds fault with others, but tries to find his own, and thus rectify them as far as possible. 1.13.33. While Yudhishthira is lamenting that his uncle Dhritarashtra has left home without notice, I like this phrase as a reminder that we should examine ourselves and find our own shortcomings.
That should be a kind of discipline or a way to control the mind. When you see that it goes to somebody and finds fault with them, mostly we find fault with devotees because we don't hear so much the activities of non-devotees. And they're full of fault anyway. So when we hear a devotee, maybe the devotee is singled out for praise, or we just hear or deal with any devotee. If we find some fault, then right away we should see this is not good. So how to avoid it? One thing here is like, instead of that, if you're in a fault-finding mood, inevitably, then what about yourself? Like say you think, well, that devotee is so sinful, actually. That devotee has committed some sin. Say a devotee has committed some sinful activity. Oh, that devotee is sinful. So then you think, what about you? You're also sinful. And that would be more important for you to discover and feel regret or rectify your own sinful nature. It doesn't profit you at all, actually. Rather, you lose when you find or criticize another person for being sinful. You can be like that. This is standard mentality of a saintly person. Universally, saintly persons are like this. Examine ourselves and find our own shortcomings and rectify them as far as possible.
And I never thought that Dhritarashtra could perform any act without consulting him. But Dhritarashtra's going away from home was so confidential that it could not be disclosed even to Sanjaya. Sanatan Goswami also cheated the keeper of the prison house while going away to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And similarly, Raghunath Das Goswami also cheated his priest and left home for good to satisfy the Lord. To satisfy the Lord, anything is good, for it is in relation with the absolute truth. We also have the same opportunity to cheat the family members and leave home to engage in the service of Srimad Bhagavatam. Such cheating was necessary for a great cause, and there is no loss for any party in such transcendental fraud.
I don't have any comment here, but I think I selected it because of the personal disclosure by Prabhupada telling about how he left his family, always eager to hear something about his life. And then, of course, the whole subject matter is an astounding one, that there's a room for cheating. In particular, the cheating that's referred to here is there are people who are trying to detain you from the spiritual life, and you have some kind of obligation to them, materially or something. You can cheat on that score in order to get around them and take the spiritual life. So while there's certainly some morality involved, there's a higher morality that absolves you. So like you promised you would stay home and take care of your mother, so you have to do that. You cannot go and join the Hare Krishna movement. So then you go anyway and join the Hare Krishna movement. So you're cheating. But if you wholeheartedly take the service of Mukunda, then there's no fault in your failing at other obligations. He gives the example of Sanatana Goswami getting out of jail, Lord Chaitanya leaving his mother and young wife, Raghunath Goswami escaping his guardian, and Prabhupada after, what was it, 40 years of beautiful household life with a wife who wasn't eager to take part with preaching, in preaching with him. He wanted to use the house for preaching, and she and her son would just stay away from the preaching, and he would drink tea. He said, you have to choose between tea or me. He said, in a lighthearted way, well, then I'll take tea. And that's what she got. And we got Prabhupada. So we're glad he cheated them. One way is if they would benefit if they took it favorably, which in the case of like Lord Chaitanya's mother, there's a nice purport about her that Prabhupada says that she allowed Lord Chaitanya to go, and she's an ideal mother in doing that. And if a mother doesn't let the son go to take the Krishna consciousness, then she is ma in the sense of maya. So all mothers should follow Sachi's example. Therefore, she lamented, but she didn't demand that he had to come back. And he remained a great devotee of his mother. But at the time, she couldn't bear it if he just said, I would like to take sannyas. She would say, no, you can't take sannyas. My other son, Viswarup, he took sannyas. You promised you would stay home and you're married. How can you do? So he had to just run away. But then she accepted it. And Vishnupriya, the wife he left, she always worshipped him and performed austerities, thinking of him, chanting his holy name, Gauranga. So they were favorable by their reception. All right, we were cheated. I lost my husband. What can I do? But I still love him. I love him now he's a sannyasi. I cannot see him. It was very, she suffered in separation.